Friendly Star, sung by Peggy King, and she'll be with us in just a minute on Fresh Air. Today on Fresh Air, at about 4:20, I'll speak with Maxie Furman and Milton Frome, two comedians currently appearing in Sugar Babies. Maxie Furman has been in show business for about 52 years. He started in Yiddish musical comedy, toured the burlesque circuit, and for 15 years he was the house comedian at the Troc, Philadelphia's famous burlesque theater. Milton Frome is a comedian and straight man who's performed the burlesque circuit and appeared in over 50 films, including 16 with Jerry Lewis. We'll talk about the old burlesque circuit when they join us. There aren't many contemporary comedians who are ventriloquists. At 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Ron Lucas, a young ventriloquist and comedian who John S. Wilson of the New York Times wrote is, quote, taking ventriloquism to a new level. Lucas has won the National Laugh Contest, which is a comedy competition. He's been on The Tonight Show and is now performing his act in Sugar Babies. We'll meet him at 4 o'clock. Fresh Air's film critic Bill Van Wert will be with us at 3:45 to review two documentaries, Not a Love Story, a film about the pornography industry, and Burden of Dreams, the film about the making of Werner Herzog's jungle epic, Fitzcarraldo. So that's at 3:45. My guest now is singer Peggy King, and you may remember her from her many TV appearances in the 50s and nightclub appearances, but if you've never heard her perform, it's because in the 60s she gave up her career for a while to raise her family here in Philadelphia. Now her children have grown up, and she's starting to perform again. Before leaving the music business, she performed in the top nightclubs around the country. She was a regular on the Mel Torme Show on CBS TV, and that was the first daily color cast program. For 3 years, she was a regular on the George Gobel Show. She also guest starred on nearly all the TV variety shows of the 50s. Now she's performing again, and on January 30th and 31st, she'll perform in Philadelphia with the Philly Pops. She'll do a set of Ellington songs accompanied by Mercer Ellington and the Duke Ellington Orchestra. So these performances with the Philly Pops are on the 30th and 31st at the Academy of Music. And then in April, she'll perform for 3 weeks in New York at Michael's Pub. And that's the club in New York that has become known as the place that Woody Allen plays his clarinet occasionally. So that's coming up in April. We'll be hearing more of Peggy King's recent taped music in a few minutes. Peggy King, welcome to Fresh Air, and it's great to meet you.
Thank you, Terry.
Before we really talk about your life and your career, tell us about the tape that we just heard, because we're about to hear another excerpt of it. Would you tell us how it was recorded?
The Friendly Star tape. I had written an industrial show for my husband's company after six, and we did it on the coast in California because we had to ship it back here so people could learn it. There were models, there were singers, there were dancers involved, and we had an hour left over. And even when I did an industrial, I always tried to get the best musicians. I mean, that's Eddie Samuels on piano and Al Viola on guitar. That's Louis Belson on drums and Buddy Clark. I mean, it's all the best guys. We had an hour left over. You pay for 3 hours with the musicians and for studios and engineers. And we had an hour left, and the guy said, gee, we really like to have something for ourselves. Let's make something. So we made these 9 sides and Friendly Star. Someone would call out a tune and say, why don't you do such and such? And that would be it. I mean, 1 take each, and that was it.
I'd like to play another selection from this tape, and we're going to hear It Never Entered My Mind.
My favorite.
And this is singer Peggy King.
Once I laughed when I heard you say, never entered my mind. Once you told me that if you'd scold me, that I'd awaken with the sun and order orange juice for one. It never entered my mind. You have what I lack myself. Scorned me, I'd sing a maiden's prayer again and wish that you were there again to get into my hair again. It never entered.
Peggy King from an unreleased session, and that was It Never Entered My Mind, and she lives in Philadelphia and will be performing on the 30th and 31st with the Philly Pops, and it will be a set of Johnny Mercer songs. I had said it would be Ellington songs, but she'll be doing a set of Johnny Mercer songs. Peggy King, I never heard you sing until you loaned us the tape that we're listening to, and when I heard you sing, I said there are two things that I was wondering. One is, why have I never heard you sing before? Because I enjoyed your music so very much. The other was, why did you stop singing professionally? Because I felt, gee, someone of such wonderful talent to you know, not be recording and sharing it. Why did you stop performing for a while?
Well, when I moved to Philadelphia with my when I married Sam Rudofker and moved here, first, I had two kids in a year and 10 days, which kept me very busy, you know. Although I did have a network radio show in New York until the day before Jonathan was born, but I have all those tapes. That's great to listen to those. I just didn't want to be Aunt Mommy, you know. I'm not trying to make a big deal of it. I mean, I have to be very careful when I say these things because I don't want to step on the toes of anybody out there who did remain in the business and still raise their kids. But I couldn't handle it. I really could not handle both things. I was going to fail at one or the other, and I wanted not to fail at my marriage and with my kids. And furthermore, I think also it had something to do with being in Philadelphia. Had I lived in New York or Los Angeles or even Chicago, I might have continued to sing. But Philadelphia was just enough out of the mainstream of pop and jazz things that there was really no place for me to work. And I continued to write. I've always been a lyricist, you know, and I continued to write industrials and things like that. Or also I had a lot of commitments, which I continued, I went ahead and did Mr. President in the big theater in the Round in Texas. You know, it's in Irving, Texas. It's I think it's the biggest one in the United States. I felt compelled to do it because after the Kennedy assassination, that wonderful play, which was the last of Irving Berlin's plays, was going down the tubes, and because a president had been assassinated, and I felt that that was not right, and I went and did that. That was that for about a month, and I would go here and there, and I would do. I never really stopped singing. I would do a benefit for Settlement Music School or one for Temple Music Festival or something. I never really stopped singing, but I stopped singing for my supper, I think is the best way to put it. You know, I believe that it's very difficult to go out and kill yourself on the boards. You know, I'm also an actress and I love acting. I think it's very difficult to go out there and, you know, work very hard and it's a very hard life. On the road when you really don't need the money. I think it's, I don't, there's something in human nature that keeps you from, of course, now the next question is, why am I doing it now? I certainly no longer need the money. I'm doing it now for a couple of reasons. My children are both at Temple University. My son is very interested in coming into the music business. He's a very talented singer. And I just, both of them felt cheated that people like you, you know, would say to them, you know, we never heard your mother sing. Or people would say to them, have you, you know, you missed a lot. You didn't hear your mother or didn't see her work. And I sort of felt like maybe it was time to do it. And my husband, people are constantly accusing him of having taken me out of the business, you know, out of circulation, which is far from true. Nobody enjoys me or encourages me more than Sam. And it was the time. And the third thing is that nostalgia is absolutely, I mean, it is mad. In New York, it is just, there's not, you don't hear anything but nostalgia. You don't hear anything but the 40s and the 50s. It's incredible. So it really was the time for me to do this again, I think.
In that period where you weren't singing much professionally, were there things that you couldn't do because it would leave you feeling regretful, like certain singers who you'd turn on the radio or variety shows on TV?
That's a real good question. No one's ever asked me, and it's true. You know, I used to sit and I would see somebody come along who I really felt was a bad singer, and I would say, I would just want to, you know, run and strangle the person, you know, like find where they were and track them down. Sure. I mean, that's human nature. Sure, I felt like that. And of course, I would also see a show come along that I really would like to be in. You know, a show would, I wanted very much to do The Road Company of same time next year. I really felt, I knew I was just right for it. But there are personal, my husband's mother was still alive at that time, and I cared very deeply for my in-laws. And she would have absolutely not lived through the language in that show had I done it in this city, you know. So every time they would ask me to do something here, like Playhouse in the Park, it was either a hooker or somebody, you know, absolutely a low life, you know. I really felt that was a proper thing for me to do at that time. Now today I would go and do it. Maybe I didn't have myself together enough. I'm very together now. Somebody, do you know Arthur Hamilton? Is that a familiar name to you? Yeah. He wrote Cry Me a River.
Oh, I know the song.
I know him, you know, he's a very dear friend of mine, and he saw me very recently and he said to me, Peggy, you're like a general in search of an army. You're so strong and you're so you really do know what you're doing. I was always sure when I was singing what I was doing. I was never quite as sure as a person as I am now. I'm very, I'm really a very secure lady.
You're going to be starting a second career now with the benefit of all the experience that you've gotten from the first time around and the benefit of really feeling like you know who you are and you're secure in yourself. What are some of the things you're going to do now that you might not have known to do the first time?
Well, I'll never let Mitch Miller tell me again that I can't record a song because it has the word plebeian in it, you know, and then that song will go on and become, you know, Cry Me a River. I don't think I'm ever going to worry about some of those very, very in jazz people who do not consider me a jazz singer because I don't really know what they're doing anyhow, that turning around and turning their back to the audience and everything and referring to themselves in the third person. I mean, I just don't believe those people make any difference to me any longer, because the people who I really care about, you know, the people I really feel are good musicians, don't label people anyhow. I don't know what kind of a singer I am. I mean, I could sing on the Broadway stage. I'm a pop singer. I'm certainly a singer of standards songs. And a lot of people think I'm a jazz singer. So it just depends on what you think is a jazz singer, you know. But I won't worry about that anymore. I mean, if I want to sing Irving Berlin in an album, I don't really care if the jazz people think Irving Berlin is corny, then that's their problem, not mine.
I guess you've experienced jazz people finding stuff like that corny.
They just pick out, like, if you're not Ella and you're not Sarah, or if you're not, I'm trying to think of a few more people, you know, Carmen McRae. I mean, you know, the jazz people put Barbara Streisand down quite a lot. They don't consider her a jazz singer. The truth is she's very much a jazz singer. She's very, very deeply rooted in Lena Horne. You can, if you listen, there it is, you know. So I don't care any longer. I mean, I don't really, Mel Torme certainly sings everything there is to sing, and he is a great jazz singer. So they can call me whatever they want to, really.
You worked with Mel Torme, and
yes.
I want to talk about that in a few minutes, but I'd like to play another one of the selections from the tape that you've brought with you, which is unfortunately not available to us on record. But we're going to hear My Romance. Do you want to tell us why you sing this song?
Because Al Viola, who was the guitar player on this session, who was Sinatra's guitar player for 25 years, was just bananas about My Romance, and he had not heard anybody do it in a long time. And I think Rodgers and Hart had a time when they really weren't done very much. And this is, he wanted me to do it, and also because I was originally taken to MGM Pictures. I was there for 2 years. During the time, I did nothing but take lessons because the motion picture industry, you know, fell apart when TV came along. But the film they took me there to do was Jumbo. And, you know, Little Girl Blues from that. And so is My Romance. And I guess I kind of sort of held a feeling about the song.
You do it really well. Let's listen
Thank
to
you.
It.
My romance doesn't have to have a moon in the sky. My romance doesn't need a blue lagoon standing by. No man of May, no twinkling stars, no hideaway, no soft guitars. My romance doesn't need a castle rising in Spain, nor a dance to a constantly surprising refrain. Wide awake, I can make my most fantastic dreams come true. My romance doesn't need a thing but you. Thank you. guitars. My romance doesn't need a castle. Rising in Spain, nor a dance to a constantly surprising refrain. Wide awake, I can make my most fantastic dreams come true. My romance doesn't need a thing but you.
Peggy King singing Rodgers and Hart's My Romance. Peggy King lives in Philadelphia. She's not been performing much since the mid-60s when she took time out to raise her family. She's performing again. She'll be with the Philly Pops singing a set of Johnny Mercer songs on the 30th and 31st of this month. And then in April, she'll be doing a three-week run at Michael's Pub in Manhattan.
And I think, excuse me, I think some of your listeners would probably be interested in my accompanist with the Philly Pops, because it's Dick Marks, you know, M-A-R-X, who's coming in from Chicago to do this with me. He is, you know, a very great jazz pianist in his own right. And this is he's a labor of love. He just doesn't go and do this, you know. But we're very close to his family, and he's coming to do this. So I think there are some people out there who'd probably love to hear him. He's a
Some of our listeners who haven't heard you before may be wondering, is she one of the King sisters?
Oh, my, that question. No, I am not. There were nine of them, and I am none of them. No, I'm not.
You mentioned before that you were at, I think it was MGM, in training there for...
Yeah, those were the days when they really, I mean, you learned to fence, and you learned to, you learned diction, and you learned everything. I unfortunately, there were no movies. They were very, very frightened of television then. But that really didn't matter to me. I really, I never thought about movies so much. You know, I did later do some movies. I really wanted to get to Broadway. That was the thing for me. But by the time I got around to that, I met my husband. So he came to Mr. Kelly's in Chicago, and Dick Marks was playing there for me. And Irv Kupcinet brought him in, and we met, and that was it. I mean, I knew immediately that I was going to, and immediately, not 10 minutes, but 20 minutes later, I certainly did know. I mean, I knew very quickly that this was what I wanted. And he's very deeply involved in music. You know, he's on the board of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and he's involved with Settlement Music School and the opera, and he's he had his own opera company here at one time, and I've learned a great deal. I would say that the 15 years, from now, 15 years back, I've been more exposed to classical music and classical singers and opera than I have to pop music.
Has that affected your singing, do you think?
I think so. Yes, I know it has. I know I spin a much longer line now because of listening to, watching, you know, a Benita Valente, who is also a Philadelphian, and watching them fill up with air and conserve it and slowly letting it out, and listening to some of the long lines. Yes, I think my phrasing is a little different. I hope it's better. You know, I mean, I like it better. I think these tapes we've been playing show some of that. It's, goodness, I don't want to get to sounding like, you know, Vivian Della Chiesa. That's not what I'm saying here. Yes, it has improved me as a singer, yes.
In the 50s when you were working, were there ways that people tried to package you that you didn't especially want to be packaged?
Oh, yes, of course. They wanted me to be Judy Garland.
Who wanted you to be
Judy
Garland?
Everybody wanted me to be Judy Garland. I mean, especially at Metro, they wanted me to be Judy because they were having a lot of health problems with her. And that's what they brought me there for in the first place, you know, to hold me over her head, I guess. And with darker hair, I look a lot more like her, too. Although she never thought so. She always said, why do they say you look like me? You're prettier than I am. But that's the way she was. She put herself down very badly, always. But there is a quality. There is a certain pitch, a certain quality that you see people think of Judy Garland now as Liza Minnelli. They think that Liza sings exactly as her mother, which is not true at all. There was in the early days of Garland, she was a very quiet. She sang Harold Arlen, and she sang Mercer, and she sang a lot of these wonderful songs were written for her. You know, Last Night When We Were Young, things like that. And she was almost a jazz singer. I think she showed up at the Newport Jazz Festival once. So she was not a jazz singer, but she was a very free, very, very interpretive singer, you know. And there was the quality. There was some kind of quality that made people connect me to her. And it almost ruined me. It just was almost the end for me.
Why?
Because she was very much alive, and you can't, you just cannot make a career of being someone else. I think you can be... There are incidents where, for instance, I have always felt that at the very beginning, Victor Moan was very much like Sinatra, you know. But he went on and was able to hang on. Or you have a case of, I'm trying to think of somebody who really imitated. Well, I think that Diane Carroll imitated Lena Horne very seriously at first, but she also moved on from that. Streisand at the very beginning was a direct cross between Judy Garland and Lena Horne at the very beginning. And there are millions of people out there imitating Ella Fitzgerald, you know. I just don't... There's really no future in being an imitator unless you're Rich Little. There's just no... I don't want it to sound like anybody else.
Once you were put into that mold, though, how did you work your way out of it?
I don't know if I ever did. I don't know if I... They were still, you know, at the end of when I stopped singing, it was still that people were still talking to me about Judy Garland. And I just never really went along with it. At Metro, the publicity that went out on me at Metro said that I sounded like Judy Garland and that I looked like Lana Turner, you know, and that's... They did everything in their power. I mean, there are pictures. I've got Metro pictures of me where you don't know if it's who it is. You don't know if it's... Everybody looked alike at Metro. I mean, I look like Esther Williams in some of those pictures. You know, you're made up in exactly the same... By the same person. The same lighting is used on you. The same person does your hair. The same person comes in and takes the photographs. And everybody looks like everybody else. If you're... It's just like a factory there, you know. If you're lucky, you get out. If you're lucky, you move on. Debbie Reynolds was lucky. She moved on and is now going to go into Woman of the Year on Broadway. If you're lucky, and she's a very, very hardworking girl, though. If you're lucky, you move on. If you're not, you become one of those, you know, Ann Miller moved on. People, there, you know, you can move on, but a lot of people just never moved on beyond those movie studios, which was Never Neverland, you know.
In the 50s, you did a lot of performing on TV. You were regular on the George Gobel Show and then on the Mel Torme Show and appeared on all the variety shows.
Everything, yes.
Was there a kind of singing you were expected to do on TV in the 50s?
That's interesting. There were two complete schools of thought about me. There were people who only wanted me to sing ballads, and there were other people who only wanted me to sing real, you know, Johnny One Note and big belting, you know, Swanee. If I would do two songs on one show, you know, like a Como show or three, then I would try to do one of each. But if I only had to do one song, I almost always pick a ballad. I don't know why. I like to sing up songs. I like to sing, mid song. I love the Benny Goodman sound. You know, the swing things, Woody Herman. But I. Maybe it's because if you only have 3 minutes to say something, you can say more in a ballad. I mean, I usually try to include the verse if I can, too, which is almost, except for Bobby Short and Mel Torme, that's almost gone now. Because the verses do set it up. You know, I mean, I love to play that game with other singers where someone sings a verse and everybody tries to jump in and say what it is.
And a lot of the 50s variety shows, the singer would be wearing an evening gown and then there'd be a line of male dancers behind her,
yes.
And a set behind
yes.
The dancers. Did you like performing in that kind of setting?
Yeah, sure, that was fun, you know, with the choreographer and all that sort of, and dancing and running and the long, glamorous. I don't believe there's a girl alive who doesn't have that Cinderella thing going on in her head, that fairy princess thing. You know, oh, sure, I loved the gowns and I loved the dancers and I loved the little short costumes with the net stockings and the high heels and the makeup and the... I really loved the performing part of it. I didn't like the some of the things that went along with the personal end of it.
Like what?
There were a lot of fans out there who were scary, and a couple of times I had to have you know, some police with me, and I just never liked that. I never liked the idea that somebody might get hurt, you know, standing around where I was singing or something. I didn't like the fact that you have no personal life, and I also was very distressed with the fact that being little and being blonde seems to go hand in hand. People think you're stupid. I never liked that. You know, if those people that think that never met Goldie Hawn, or they never met the late Judy Holliday, because they certainly, one thing has nothing to do with the other, nothing.
Speaking with Peggy King, and I want to play another song that you've recorded before we talk some more. And we're going to hear How About Me, which is, well, why don't you tell us about the song and the setting that it was recorded in?
Irving Berlin. Irving Berlin is still alive, you know. He's 96 years old, and he is, if anybody, anywhere in the United States is doing a Berlin song, you can just make sure he knows about it. You know, he's very, very, very active. He lives on Sutton Place, and he's extremely active. He walks every day. You can see him walking there. I did a concert at the Walnut Street Theater a couple of summers ago, and for the Temple Music Festival, and I did a set of Irving Berlin, and I did I really did some weird things. I left my heart at the Stage Door Canteen, which was from World War II, which was no one would ever hear, and the audience was so happy to hear it. And I did a song from World War I. I did Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning. And Alexander's Ragtime Band. And I did this one ballad, which I think is Berlin's best ballad.
Let's hear it. It's called How About Me? And my guest, Peggy King, is singing.
It's over, all over, and soon somebody else will make a fuss over you. But how about me? It's over, all over, and soon somebody else will tell her friends about you. But how about me? You found somebody new, but what am I to do? I still remember you when you have forgotten. And maybe a baby will climb upon your knee and put his arms around you. But how about me? You found somebody new, and she looks good to you. But what am I to do? Broken hearted, and maybe a baby will climb upon your knee and put his arms around you. But how about me?
Peggy King recorded in concert at the Walnut Street Theater. And Peggy King lives in Philadelphia. She hasn't been singing too much professionally for about the past 15 years or more, but she's going to be performing again 30th and the 31st of January. She'll be with the Philly Pops doing a set of Johnny Mercer songs. She'll have a three-week stay at Michael's Pub in April in Manhattan, and I don't know what's happening after that. We'll find out a little later.
Well, I don't know yet either. I'm really just working on that. I know positively that Butch Miles is going to be my drummer. Do you know who he is? He was with the Count Basie for a long time. He's a really... The joke is that he drove the Basie band like a bus. You know, he really did drive the band. He's going in with me. I don't know. Either Dick Marks will come in from Chicago or Dick Hyman. Are you familiar with him?
Richard Hyman? Yeah.
Either I'm writing a song right now with Richard Hyman. He's putting the music to a lyric of mine. And so is Arthur Hamilton. I think what I'd really like to do is... I guess I'll do an album at Michael's. That's getting to be, you know, Jackie Kane and Rory Crowell did one. Jonathan Schwartz did one live at Michael's, which is, I think Concord is doing them. They're very interesting. And then I would like to do an album of my own songs, very much. I'd like to do that. And eventually what I'd like to do is an album with my son, where I, starting with me and then us, and then going on into him. You know, which I don't know anybody that's ever done that. Would be interesting.
You've known several composers very well, including Johnny Mercer and
oh, yes.
Frank Lesser.
Yeah.
What kind of advice have they given you and other composers given you about interpreting their own songs?
Well, Johnny, I worked on a show on television in L.A. with Johnny called Musical Chairs with Johnny and Bobby Troup, during which time we wrote songs on the air. People would call an idea out from the audience, and we would write the song there on the air. And Johnny would write the last eight bars, naturally. I learned a lot from that, an awful lot, and those are two very fine songwriters. If Johnny sang one of, I think that Bing Crosby was very influenced by Johnny, because Johnny would bring the song in and sing it for the first time, and Bing would hear it, and then there's no other way ever to sing it because Johnny sang his own song so well, you know. Frank Lesser is in a class by himself. I mean, I think Guys and Dolls stands all by itself. There's no question about it, and so does the Robert Weedy Show, Most Happy Fella. Frank was just he just loved good singing, and you would go to the house and you would just find yourself going through the entire score. He would sing and you would sing and he would sing and somebody else would sing, and he sang very badly, of course. I shouldn't really say that, because Mercer sang very well. If you sang it well, he liked it. That was it. But Harold Arlen, I remember doing a Perry Como show once, and I was singing Happiness Is Just a Thing Called Joe, and he pointed out to me in the sheet music that it was happiness is just, to rhyme with ness, a thing called Joe. You know, very black colloquial. And it was very difficult for me to do that. But of course he was right. He was absolutely right. Arlen really knew what he wanted from him. He really had an idea in his mind about how he wanted a song sung.
But how do you feel about that? Because after a composer writes it, especially if it's not for a show where it's being sung in a theatrical setting, do you think it's really in the performer's right to interpret it any way they please, and that it's really out of the dominion of the composer?
Well, now, I have just heard one of my own lyrics sung in a nightclub for the first time. And I just almost died. I just... When I knew that he was going to sing it, I sang this with Eddie Samuels, who was the pianist on all these things we've been playing, and a songwriter in his own right, a very good one. And he told me, we finished the song, and he said he was going to sing it in this place where he was working. And I felt better. It was easier when I had my children. It's the worst kind of labor pains. And he's a wonderful singer. It wasn't that I didn't think he would do it very well. It's a man's song. I couldn't even do it. But it was I understand. I should have done this a long time ago, because I now understand the pain that a songwriter must go through when someone does something awful to their lyrics. He didn't. He did them beautifully. But I'm going to have more and more and more of that. I'm writing a song now with Arthur Hamilton for Kenny Rogers, and I'm writing a song with Dick Hyman that I'm going to use myself at Michael's. And I can understand why people stand backstage and dance when they've done the choreography, or sing along, you know, especially if somebody takes a really big, really interprets it. I mean, changes maybe the meaning, changes a word that changes the whole meaning. You've heard that. I mean, I will get 1,000 phone calls after this, I know. But, you know, Sinatra really does. Sometimes in later years, Sinatra can change the entire feeling of a song. He can change the entire meaning of a song by sticking in a little phrase of his own. Not that it matters, because he's Sinatra; he can do anything, and rightly so. He has a place of his own. But can you imagine what it's like to be a young songwriter and, you know, to take your song into somebody and they sing it? Here's an example. I showed up once at a record date to do a song of Arthur Hamilton's called Any Questions, and I had also done it on Dragnet. And on Dragnet it was done as a jazz song, which is what it was. And when I showed up to do it for Columbia Records, the first thing I saw was Mitch Miller, and the second thing I saw was a harpsichord. And it should never have been done with a jazzed-up, you know, harpsichord. And Arthur was there, Hamilton, and Arthur just about expired that night, you know? It's, you have your own ideas about how you, I'm going to have to stop this, because if I'm going to give a song to a friend like Mathis, he's going to sing it the way he wants to sing it, you know, or Tony Bennett. I mean, I'm going to have to knock that off. I'm going to have to separate that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I've never been guilty of that. I never wanted to change a song. But I bet I have. I bet I have without really meaning to. You get bored after a while and you fool around. If you do a song, although that I could sing these songs that you've been listening to, if I sing them 100 times, they mean the same thing to me. But we were talking about it, never entered my mind. A lot of people sing that very, very poignantly and very, 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 you know, my life is over. And I have a different feeling when I sing it. My feeling is, you know, well, you messed that up. You know, well, here's another fine mess you've gotten us in. Everybody has their own ideas.
I really regret to say that we're running out of time.
Oh,
the time is just flowing.
I don't know where it went.
But, you know, a lot of people will be coming to hear you perform now, and some of them will remember your performances from 20, 25 years ago. What do you think they will be expecting, and do you think that, how do you think you're going to compare to their expectations that they have from past memories?
Well, I think that music lovers, you know, people who care, one, are going to know that I probably will do good songs. And anyhow, there are no bad Johnny Mercer songs, really. I think that people come expecting to hear a stylist, certainly a lady with her own ideas, which I always was. And, of course, musicians always come to hear the intonation. I think what they'll find, it's very simple. I think all you're going to find is Pretty Perky Peggy King, which was what I was always called, just grown up, that's all.
Does that label bother you, the Pretty Perky Peggy King?
Well, I think it's kind of silly for a lady with a son who's going to be 21, you know. I don't mind. I really don't. I mean, it's certainly not insulting. I think that they're just going to find Peggy King exactly as she was, 20 years older and 20 years wiser, and a lot better singer, I hope.
We're about to hear a song that I'm sure no one in our audience has heard before.
No, it's never been played.
Do you want to tell us briefly
about it? This is Eddie Samuels. It's Eddie's father wrote Jim, and he wrote Elmer's Tune and a lot of things. So he knew he went to ASCAP meetings with his dad when he was a kid, and he knew Johnny Mercer from the time he was very young. When he was 18, he took this I won't give it away by telling you, this very famous chunk out of a classical song, and he wrote a melody from this, and he gave it to Johnny. And 2 days later, Johnny saw his father somewhere, and he handed him an envelope with a lyric that he had written on the back of it. But nothing was ever done with it. It was never published. It was never, you know, and then Eddie played it for me, and I just went crazy over it. And I asked Eddie, when he was here doing the temple thing, if we could do it. And we did it. And this is it, live.
Okay, it's called Oh What a Memory We Made. And before we hear it, I want to tell you how much I enjoy your singing and how
glad I
am to have been introduced to it and to you.
Thanks for being here. I needed the encouragement. Thanks.
And if you want to hear Peggy King perform, she'll be at with the Philly Pops at the Academy of Music on the 30th and 31st of January doing Johnny Mercer set. She'll also be in New York for 3 weeks in April at Michael's Pub. Well, and she lives in Philadelphia, I should mention that. And let's hear the song with the Johnny Mercer lyric that she just mentioned. This is called Oh, What a Memory We Made.
Oh, what a memory we made tonight. Oh, what a love scene we both played tonight. Though other arms ever held me as tight as yours, no lips as bright as yours, as impolite as yours.
Peggy King singing a song called Oh, What a Memory We Made with a lyric by Johnny Mercer. It's 8 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, 91 FM on the dial. Remind you again that Peggy King will be singing with the Philly Pops on the 30th and the 31st of January. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll be hearing from ventriloquist Ron Lucas, and ventriloquism isn't a much-practiced art nowadays, but he's very funny. It's a very good comic and ventriloquist, and is now performing with Sugar Babies. And then following that, we'll be hearing from two of the comedians who are with Sugar Babies. They're both alumni of the burlesque circuit, and that's what we'll be discussing. Well, with me now is Fresh Air's film critic, Bill Van Wert, who will be reviewing two documentaries for us today. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Terry. The two I'm going to be talking about are Burden of Dreams, Les Blank and Ring Gosling's film about the making of Fitzcarraldo by Werner Herzog. And that is playing through the Neighborhood Film Project at the International House. And the other film I'll talk about is Not a Love Story, which is a documentary look at they call it the pornography industry. Well, I have some questions about whether that's the appropriate term for it. And that film is playing at the Budco Old City Cinema. It's interesting for me to be able to do two documentary films, since we primarily focus on fiction films here, and we're talking about actors and roles and the interest of their performance and so forth. And I found that documentary, at least these two documentaries, I was having a much more personal reaction to. And ordinarily I would say that would be the other way around, that I would sit back and look at a documentary for the technical aspects, for how well it was made and so forth. So, excuse me, I had